It's that time of year again for Salisbury University's 2014 Children's and Young Adult Literature Festival. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Festival ends this Saturday and has featured a number of award-winning authors and illustrators. And with us in studio to talk about what this crop of authors and artists have brought us is Dr. Ernie Bond. He is an associate professor of education at Salisbury University. Our other guest in studio is Brian Collier. He's a native of Pocomoke City and a nationally celebrated artist and illustrator, as well as Frene Lessig and Mark Greenwood, husband and wife who have published 7 books together. Welcome to you all, first of all. And Ernie, why don't you describe a little bit about the festival, what's been going on, and anything new in terms of children's and young adults and books that you're seeing at this point?
Oh, sure. Well, the festival's been going on since Monday. We had Rita Williams-Garcia in.
That's right.
And, oh, boy, she was going to schools all over the Eastern Shore, and here at Salisbury University, she spoke to over 350 kids on Tuesday, which was just amazing to see 5th through 7th graders there interacting with her. After she spoke for 40 minutes, all the kids in the audience had their hands up wanting to ask her questions, which that age group, you tend to think that it's going to be hard to get them to engage with literature, but she had them hooked.
And explain who she is, by the way, for all.
Rita Williams-Garcia is, she writes mainly books for the middle school, intermediate age. She's won the Coretta Scott King Award this year and once before, which was one of the amazing things this year. We had both of the Coretta Scott King Award winners for the year, which was Rita Williams-Garcia for author and Brian Collier for illustrator. So she's an amazing author. And then last night we had the Young Author Ceremony on campus, and Brian Collier spoke at that. And again, the room was so packed, we had standing room only. It was just amazing. We weren't expecting so many people to come out. So it's really cool to see authors of this caliber coming to the Eastern Shore and having people here get so excited about interacting with literature, which of course is why we have the Children's Literature Festival and why we have people coming from as far away as Australia to talk about the books that they've written and the awards that they've won and to get kids to engage with the literature.
And as you survey, by the way, children's literature and young adult literature, any new trends, or are we just seeing a repetition of things in the past, or what do you see going on?
Well, we still have that idea that young adult literature is the area that's selling so much right now. I mean, you know, after the Hunger Games and Twilight and Harry Potter and all of that, you've got a lot of publishers that are still looking for that paranormal romance and dystopian futuristic thing, which, you know, is a trend that's still going. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine it's going to go away anytime soon. The Divergent and that series
is coming
doing
up
extremely well. But you've got a lot of young people reading, which is incredible. I mean, there's the size of our festival, the audiences coming to our festival has grown tremendously. So it's very cool to see so many kids engaging with literature.
All right, by the way, are you surprised at how a number of these young adult books have been turned into these films, actually trilogies in some cases? I mean, and you're not just attracting, in these trilogies, by the way, you're not just attracting just young adults who obviously probably read it, but you're attracting adults. I mean, a whole like culture of folks that are much older than that.
Which of course is one of the reasons why that type of literature is doing so well. You have young kids reading it, you've got teenagers reading it, you've got adults reading it. But the same thing is happening with picture books to an extent. You've got cross ages reading picture books now. And in Australia, that's a huge thing. Picture books that are being read by young adult readers, by adults, because you have a sophistication in picture books that's truly amazing today, where you can have younger kids engaging with these books and you can have teenagers engaging with these books and thinking about visual literacy and trying to read the illustrations and so on. I mean, Brian Collier's books, for example, Knock Knock, which just came out, I was using with middle school students the other day, and the symbolism in some of those illustrations really gets them thinking about the meaning, about the context, about what's actually happening in the book, which is truly amazing.
I want to turn to Brian Collier. As we notice, he's a native of Pocomoke City, just right down the way, I guess it is.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about how you got started with illustrating these kinds of books.
Well, I graduated from Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, New York. Mm-hmm. And the year that I graduated, I found myself in a Barnes & Noble, and I gravitated toward the picture book section. I never hadn't really been thinking about picture books, but I was just there because I knew art. It was art, and I looked at it. Mm-hmm. And I looked around, and I didn't see any books that sort of looked like me. Because I grew up with, like, Snowy Day and Whistle for Willie by Ezra Jack Keats and Harold and Purple Crayon, and these were my favorite books. And only because that little boy in the lead characters was a little African-American boy, and they looked like just like me. And so I said, well, a light bulb went off, and I said, well, maybe I'll make a book. And so that was my journey to begin to make picture books. And it took me 7 years. I went door to door to every major publishing house in Manhattan for 7 years until I got my first book deal.
What was it like? I mean, you have to have a lot of determination for 7 years. I mean, what did they say to you by saying no, they don't?
Well, sometimes they didn't say anything.
Uh-huh. Sometimes, right. Sometimes, that was the nicest thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And sometimes they left little notes. We love the artwork. We just don't have any text for you. We don't have any material for you to illustrate. That was the biggest thing. But I didn't give up because I was excited about the whole process. It was a whole world that opened up by just sitting in the lobby of a publishing house with all the new books. And so that was turning me on. And then I would see little things like Julie Andrews walk by in a publishing house. Now, I don't watch Mary Poppins and all right. that stuff, but I knew who she was, you know. Right. And they whisked her by. I said, well, something's happening in there. And then I was in Scholastic publishing house, and I think I saw Will Smith walk by, and they closed the bookshelf behind him like a magical door opened up, and they slipped him in there. I'm like, I don't believe this. So I was like, well, I got to stay with this because this is incredible. It held me for 7 years. So I said, something's going on in there, and so I have to be a part of this thing.
No. And by the way, and I want to talk about, before we go to the latest book, you wrote or illustrated a book called Dave the Potter, Artist, Poet, and Slave. And describe the book for us in terms of its concept and what you were trying to achieve here.
Well, Dave the Potter is about an enslaved potter out of Edgefield, South Carolina. 200 years ago, he made pottery on a plantation, and they used it to store water, oil, and grain in. But Dave could read and write, so he wrote poetry on the outside of these clay pots that he made. He made 40,000 pots in his lifetime, I know, because we went down to the plantation and pulled the inventory sheet and saw he made that many pots. He lived to be about 70 years old, but he wrote the most incredible prose on these pots. He wrote on the pot that we focus on in the book. He said, I wonder where is all my relations, friendship to all in every nation. And he signed it Dave, and he dated it. It was illegal for slaves to read and write. He boldly pronounced that he could read and write, and that was his act of defiance. Some slaves in the Underground Railroad escaped. That was their act of defiance. This was Dave's. He was an artist. To be an artist under these kind of conditions, I had to believe that when he was making those pots, it was his only glimpse of freedom that he had a day. And the poet, and he became a vessel himself because this stuff sort of flowed through him. He didn't have time to craft the poem,
right?
You know,
it was a few words, yeah, but yeah. Nonetheless, but saying a great deal in very few
absolutely.
Words.
Absolutely, he condensed it down. That's the brilliance of his artistry. He could encapsulate a thought just like that and do it. And well, my question when he wrote that text, I said, well, he died and was born in Edgefield, South Carolina. How does he talk about another nation when he's never? Well, we were right when we tell our children, if you can read and write, you can go anywhere and do anything. You can transport. So the book is really about literacy. And it comes through a slave 200 years ago.
By the way, now he made these pots. Mm-hmm. I mean, how did this slip through this white slave society? I mean, where did it go?
I asked that too. I said, well, was everybody illiterate, and maybe that's this crazy Dave scribbling on a pot? That was one thought. I said, well, maybe that's a plausible conclusion. But somehow Dave just did it. He didn't sign all the pots.
Right.
And there was a slave rebellion in Edgefield, South Carolina, at a particular time which Dave lived. Dave didn't sign any pots. So he knew exactly when it was okay to bring it out and how to pull back when the scene was really hot, you know, and uprise. It was an uprise in the area. So he was really, his strategy was, I'll do it when it's plausible, and I think I can get away with it. And he did it over and over. But he signed quite a number of pots. And the thing about it is, how is that no one discovered these pots until 25 years ago?
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah. Oh, well, who used them at the time? Do you know?
Well, farms and plantations came from all over the country
to get these pots
to bring them back to store their meat and grain and water in. So they're scattered out around the country, but mainly down in the southern area.
Now, then tell me a little bit about the artistry. I mean, because as I looked through, I was able to go through some of the pictures. They're all sort of like earth tones. They're all, I mean, there's a certain subdued quality to them, and yet, sort of the largeness of the figures, the objects, whether it's him or it's the pots. I mean, they sort of stand in stark contrast, as if you're using a great deal of a composition to really kind of bring this thing out, as opposed to, say, bright colors, that kind of. Why did you choose these subdued colors, and how did you do that?
Oh, well, I visited the plantation. I went down to Edgefield, South Carolina, and I met a potter. His name is Stephen Farrell. He's a master potter. And he showed me all the different kinds of clays that are readily available as a natural resource in South Carolina. Hmm. He pulled out orange clay, yellow clay, and they pulled porcelain out of the ground there. Hmm. Pristine white.
Wow.
You know, so it's an abundance. It's no wonder this was the mainstay of economics there, because it's an abundance of clays and different types of clays right there. You can just dig in the ground and pull it all out. And a river ran right through the little city, little town. So it was perfect conditions. It was perfect for potters to do this. And so that spoke to me. The colors spoke to me, that earth tone. And if you look at even the sky, it's a warm blue because of the heat.
Right.
So I'm talking about clay of the earth, the heat of living down south and the whole plantation. And then I hide little things and little images within the image, like scenes like that, live life.
Mm-hmm.
It's just written in there. And things like, you know, I hide little subtle things into the text to help expand the text visually as a visual storyline.
And now, and also the comments that, like, you had opened just a moment ago of a series of pictures of the very large hands. Tell me a little bit about why. Tell me about that series there.
Well,
that you did.
I have it's called a gatefold, so it opens up and right. Shows you the process from the beginning when the clay is spinning on the wheel and how he's pulling out the shape of a jar. And that's what potters do. The hands that I used to model for these was a real potter, because I knew that potters would be looking at this book and I didn't want to fake it.
You want to make sure?
Yeah. So he's pulling out the shape of a jar, and the gentleman that actually did it, his name is Stephen Farrell, and I used him as a model to pose as Dave's hands. This is what Stephen Farrell looks like. He looks like Santa Claus.
Ah, okay. Yes, I see in there. He has a beard. And is sort of balding on top with glasses sliding down. Yes.
He's a real potter, master potter, and he owned three of Dave's pots.
Oh.
And that was the first time I was able to see his pots and touch Dave's pots up close. Now, the University of South Carolina, who did the archaeological dig that discovered these pots, they had them in their museum on campus. But they were under glass. You couldn't get near them.
Right.
But I was able to touch his signature, which was important to me, you know.
No, that's true. So. I was going to say, so what do you think these books mean in terms of particularly African-American kids? But, I mean, but everybody reads them.
Yes.
It's just not for African. But what do you think the distinction is? How do you read that audience?
Well, the premise of the book is about, this is American history. It's about history that was laying in plain sight and plain view for everyone. And that history is not boring. It's alive. But we walk past it all the time. And I think part of our mandate as illustrators and storytellers is to tell the stories of those. It's like an episode of Seinfeld. It seems like it's about nothing, but it's about everything.
Mm.
but everything that we miss. You know, the question I pose to a lot of kids when I'm talking with them, I say, well, something happened to you this morning. It happened to all of us. When you walked outside, you missed it, though, because it's like noticing the color of the day. We never see it. We walk through our day and we never see our day. We never take time to take in all the little subtle things that happen. As a storyteller, that's what it is. It's describing those moments that everybody misses. So artists, that's what we do. We tell you everything that you miss. And it could be the walk from here to the next room, but it's so many things that happen in between there. And as an illustrator and a storyteller, that's what I try to capture.
How do kids, because obviously you go to classrooms and you've talked to kids, how do kids respond to these books? And is there a difference between some of the white kids and the African-American kids? How do you read that? Well, or is it just simply all the same? I mean, I don't know.
They're just all kids
to me.
They're
just kids. They don't have an awareness.
Well,
do they have an awareness?
I just go back to my childhood.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, we didn't have any illustrators or authors come to our school. Mm-hmm. We had the books, but we never attached them to a human being. So when kids see me, they're in awe at the fact that I actually made a book. You know,
right.
This is what I do, you know, and it's something that you can do as well. You know, as a kid, that's my biggest thing. I mean, I know what I do and I know the artistry and the whole, you know, aesthetic thing that I do in my studio. But my main thing is to bridge the gap between who I am and who you are. And I say that you and I, we're more alike than we are different. You know, these are steps that are taken. You just work at it and you build it up. And you can do greater things. I'll be disappointed if you don't do something greater, you know. So part of it is to knock down the mystifying wall that separates us, and to show that this could be your future as well, you know.
I want to turn now to Mark Greenwood. He's, as we mentioned, he's from Australia. And amongst other things, I understand you have a passion for history, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Also a musician. What do you play?
In a previous life?
What did you play in a previous life?
In a previous life, I was a professional musician for about 20 years, playing drums and percussion and recordings.
And how was that? That was a good life?
It was great. In fact, probably because of my music background and the fact that I wrote songs and I teamed up. I was published as a songwriter before I was ever published as a book writer. And so I used to write lyrics, and I teamed up with a person who played the musical instrument, and we created songs together, which was a collaboration, which is kind of exactly what I'm doing now through books, writing the text and the words and working with illustrators to create a whole piece in like a song. So I guess my music background had a lot to do with what I'm doing now. I didn't know it at the time, but that's what happened.
Well, it's not a bad background. Yeah. How did you get into doing these children's books?
Well, I guess I was writing songs. I lived in England for a long time, and my children were born over there. I was married to my wife, Renee, who's here, and she was having her first books published, and I was watching the process of books being made. And my children didn't know anything about my country, Australia, and at that time I didn't know whether I was going to, when or how long I was ever going to be away for. So I kind of got the idea that I would write something about Australia to teach my children about my country, and so that's kind of how it started. And I wrote a book called Magic Boomerang and began the process of, that was written for really small, young age children. And as my children grew up and I returned to Australia, I looked at what they were doing as a parent at school, the history books that they were reading. And I was kind of looking at them going, golly, there's got to be a better way to bring history to life. A lot of the history books that they were reading and the history books that I had when I was young were really not very riveting at all. So I kind of, in the same way, listening to what Brian was saying, you know, coming from far away into Australia and meeting someone like Brian, and knowing that we all kind of have this passion for bringing history to life and making it real and showing that it's really, really good to know about your history, and it's good to read about it. And of course, the festival is all about literacy and reading, so it's a combination of bringing those things together. So I watched what my children were doing, and I thought there's got to be a better way. And so I started to I wrote a book about an outlaw character from Australia, and he wasn't such a bad guy. He was just a little rascal who kept escaping from prison every time he was put in jail years ago. And the kids love the idea of rascal characters who never really do anything terribly wrong except for drive everyone in authority crazy. And that was the beginning of my love of, kind of developed the passion for research, going to the places where history happens. You know, when you go to these places and you're actually at the site where something happened, you know, 100, 200 years ago, and you can feel the clay, as Brian was talking about, or walk through the area and visualize what it was like. It's not only does it help illustrators, but it helps writers incredibly. To me now, writing is about the writing process, but it's also about the adventures that I have in writing, going to the places where I really have read about all my life, and now I want to go there and write it and bring it to life for kids. So writing to me is about adventures.
So you sort of, in one sense, you sort of combine what was essentially, I guess, the simplicity of say writing music lyrics, which is requires you to write very succinctly and lyrically, with this sort of passion for history, I guess. Is that a way to describe it?
Well, history, the stories in history are incredibly complex, and I always find that sometimes I'm on the end of a chain of people who've been interested in the subject that I've been interested in, and generally the process of research unearths all those people who've written books before. And then for me, to make the books that I'm doing, is trying to distill the essence of a story, find the thing that will appeal to, that will draw young people into the reading of the story. And that probably is the hardest thing about writing. The books that I write in Australia, they're called picture books for older readers. So they're what we call upper primary school and high school. And they are studying picture books in high school in Australia. So it's a way of kind of distilling all the essence of a really, really huge story and making it something that's readable, enjoyable, and also that you learn something from, most importantly.
So tell me then a little bit, it's this book called Simpson and His Donkey. Who is Simpson? Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, in Australia, we revere people, the people from that have represented their country in war. And in the First World War, there was a fellow called Jack Simpson, or John Simpson. Kirkpatrick was his real name. Jack Simpson was his nickname. He saved about 300 lives at a place called Gallipoli in 1915 using a small little donkey. And he used the donkey to bring soldiers down through the battlefield, through the bullets and bombs. And people couldn't believe how he did it, because it seemed like a lot of the religious soldiers said that angels walked by this guy's side, because how did he walk through all that shrapnel and bullets and save all those lives with his little donkey? And he became really an Anzac legend to the soldiers that watched what he did. However, he has never received any award for bravery. In Australia, our highest award for bravery is called the Victoria Cross. And one of the rules of getting the Victoria Cross is that it's only for one act of bravery. And so this guy has been denied his Victoria Cross because he did 300 acts of bravery. And so I always thought that it's an amazing story. It needed to be told. And surprisingly, it got released in America. In Australia it came out as the Simpson and his Donkey, and in America it came out here as the Donkey of Gallipoli. So over here they've changed the story around a little bit to look at the idea that there was also his animal, and the bravery of the animal, the little donkey called Duffy. So it's still the same story. It's just the twist on the title has made it perhaps something that would be appealing for young children here. So I'm still surprised that children in America are learning one of our great war stories. But yeah, it's a story that's, I think, universal. Bravery, attachment to an animal, that these two become absolutely inseparable. And so it's going to the place where, at Gallipoli, where Franno and I went to research the story, and walking through the hills where he did his incredible acts of bravery. was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. And it's, as I said, it's a, we have a day every year, our Remembrance Day is called Anzac Day, for the Australian and New Zealand soldiers that went there. And it's always been, it's something that I've remembered since I was at school, and to actually go there, it was such a weird feeling. It was kind of like coming home. To find his grave at Gallipoli is very difficult because there are so many graves there. To find one amongst all the thousands there was a challenge. When I eventually did find the grave, my wife Franna and I were there taking photos, and the weirdest thing happened. A little donkey wandered up to the gravesite. And at that point, it was one of those magical moments that I think happen to all of us when we write books, those little things that happen. And Brian was saying touching Dave's signature on that pot was an amazing thing that he, for him and for me and Freno, that was one of those, just one of those magic moments that says this book will be a book and it will travel far, and it has. So,
I'm going to turn also to Frene Lessig, and she is your wife, as you've just indicated. And well, let me first of all ask you, how did you get into doing these books?
I was living on a little island in the Caribbean called Montserrat, and at that time it was pre-volcano, pre-hurricane, for some people who know about that little island. And when I landed at that island for the very first time, it felt like home. And I never felt more home than anywhere else in the world but that little island. And I loved this place so much that I started painting pictures. And I was never the best artist in the class at school. I was always worst, but I always loved to paint and draw. I started painting, and someone told me that they came over and they said I'd like to buy one of my paintings. And I thought they were crazy because I wasn't known as an artist, and they said my art was called something. It was called naive art or primitive art. I never heard of this. So somebody else bought a painting. So, whoa, this is pretty good. But when I left the island, this place stayed in my heart every day. It's kind of something about the island. I wanted to share it. And I think a lot of stories that catch us is something that we want to tell the world about. We love it so much. And I want to say something about this little island. I want, even more importantly, the children on this island to have a book about themselves. They didn't have any books there. And what Brian was saying before about recognizing yourself in a story, and I wanted to give these children pride and something they could show how special their place was and how unique. So I wrote a story, had my paintings, and 30 publishers. First one said, no, it's not for us. Next one said, well, you only publish books by people who already have books published. I'm going, well, how am I going to do that? Next one said, come back in 20 years. I think I got 3 rejections in one day. That was a tough day, but I didn't give up because I really wanted this book for the children there. I also did want to get this book in schools, libraries, and bookshops around the world. I wanted everyone to know how beautiful this place was. And finally, one publisher I went to in England, England, America, wherever they take this book, and he scratched his head and he said, well, I said, please make the book, please. I'll make my mother buy every single copy. Please, just make the book. And they did, and the book did really well because Reading Rainbow picked it up, which was a show on PBS. And so I was able to get this book out there, and LeVar Burton went to the island, and he loved the island and did a special on it. And that led me to making like 40 books. I never thought one day I'd be ever making one book, so... It all took me by surprise.
Yeah, because I understand you wanted to be a veterinarian?
Well, I had a lot of pets when I was little. I had a monkey, I had snakes.
Okay.
One day my dad brought home a camel, and we lived in New Jersey. You don't have a camel in your backyard. That was a bit of a joke that he was playing on us. But, yeah, so I had lots of animals. I loved animals. Yeah, I still do, but, yeah.
So you wrote this book, My Little Island. So what is it? So what if I open up the book, what do you find in it?
Well, when I was a child, I always loved books where I saw lots of details. That I would, if someone was reading me a story, I'd want to look into the pictures and discover new things each time I would have it read to me, or when I started reading myself. And so I like to put a lot of little things in that children would discover each time they look at it. And also something that they would also subliminally learn about a place or a picture. Something else in there that they could go back and get something more from it. And some humor. I love putting little bits of humor in. I put my cat in a lot of my books. And Some children know that I do that now, so they're always looking in the book. What, has she put her cat in the book? And
Because Carly was saying here a moment ago that he laces his things with, well, words or things like that. Mm. Do you do a little bit of that? Or you sneak a
colors.
Few things?
I use colors. Like when Mark was talking about The Simpsons in his donkey book, there's one scene where the sky's bright red, and I was just, that was me being angry about the war and about our character actually dying there. There's another scene where the water's red, and that represents all the blood, you know, the loss of life there. There's another scene where the water's purple, and that was for bravery. So I use color subliminally, and also maybe some animals sometimes. And we did a book about an outlaw in Australia called Ned Kelly. And it's a scene in his condemned jail cell the night before he was going to be executed. And in the window, there's a little bird, and that bird represents freedom, something that he'll never have. And so there are a lot of little subliminal messages. And I think as illustrators, that's where we try to do layers underneath so that children, teenagers, adults also get something from our stories.
So when you go, I'm assuming you see children and they respond. How do they respond to these books? I mean, what are they, I mean, yeah.
The most amazing thing is like, being that we're in Australia, Asia's there.
Right.
And we get to tour in India, Indonesia. And we have these stories, and children all around the world, they just love a good story. And these stories that we're speaking about today, all of us, they are universal stories any child in the world would love. So they were very well received. They just want to hear a good story.
Yeah, by the way, do you sense any differences? I mean, since you particularly in Asia and so on, do you think any differences in how children approach books of whether they're interested or not interested in, and or is there anything that appeals either one of you? I mean,
I think they appeal to them all. It's just whether they have access to them. Mm-hmm. Like in India, picture books are a real luxury, and schools there they actually ask the purpose. What is the purpose of a picture book? I mean, textbooks are more important there, and so this is a real luxury item. Picture books, and hopefully in the future, that will open up more where parents will get books for children for enjoyment or for learning as well.
What do you think, Mark?
We have a passion, both Fran and I, for working, have done now for 20 years, working with the Indigenous Aboriginal people throughout some of the very remote areas of Australia. And they have terrible struggles with literacy. Sometimes English is the third language. So we've been going out and working with the Indigenous people for a long time now and bringing stories to them. And through all those years of working with the communities and working with people now, it's sort of turning around. And because a lot of their stories, their own stories that they have are oral stories, and they've never been recorded or written down. So now they're sort of turned to us and say, work with us. We'd like you to bring one of our stories to life, which is an absolute honour. So recently I did a book called Jundamara, which was about a Indigenous outlaw it was an oral story, and it was an incredible story that needed to be told. But of course, for me, I needed to, I needed to get permission from the people to do it. And I also had to go through all the processes of making sure that as the book progressed from the written text to also the illustrations, which we were talking about the visual literacy that goes with the illustrations as well, that was approved by the people themselves. And that process took a long time, probably 4 years before I could write one word, to get the trust to do the story justice and to do it properly. And just recently, on the way here, on the flight here, it's been shortlisted for two major awards in Australia. So not only for me, it's a great honour, but I think for the Bunuba people, which are right up in the top northwest of West Australia, it's a great honour for them to see that their story has been brought to life. So in our own country, regardless of in Asia, in our own country, there are issues with literacy, and I think books where, especially picture books, can be like sequential art and things like that can be read by children who are struggling with the actual words. They can follow the story, and then the story and the words become easier for them to connect to. And so I think, you know, if we can make a difference for some of those children, because the only way I think some of those Indigenous kids are going to make their way in life is if they can read and write. And that's my passion. And I think the passion that's shared by all the authors that are here at the festival.
Prina, you're going to say something?
No, I was going to say about what Barack was going to say about the visual literacy. Like, a lot of children who can't read can follow that story. Just Mark actually filled in there. And as Brian puts those messages in there, subliminal stuff. And these are why children of all ages can read a story and come up with their own interpretations and get it in the end.
How difficult is it to, particularly we're talking about the Aboriginal population, to get into the story and to get it right? I mean, to try to see it really sort of from their point of view, I'm assuming that's really what it's all about.
Yeah, it's very difficult. But I had a lot of help along the way. For anyone who knows anything about the Indigenous people, they go through, the boys go through a period which, as a white fella, I always had heard the term initiation, where you become initiated to be a man. And that was actually a word that I'd used in this book, because the character that I'm talking about goes through that period. And the Bunuba people themselves, they said to me, we don't mind you using that word, but we'd prefer it if you used deep learning and understanding. And I went, oh, please, could I use that? Because it's a much better way of saying what was going through the period, and a much better way for children to understand what that boy in the character in the story was going through. So to work alongside communities is the way to bring some of these stories to life, and I've had that unique opportunity. Some of the communities that Frano and I visit, you have to actually get permission to go there. I mean, they're so remote, they're so difficult to get to, and the land it's their land, and so to get to the community,
we have to fly in a plane for a couple hours, then get in a car in a dirt rabbit proof fence track for 8 hours. And to get out there, and
it's very remote.
It's very remote,
and it's very traditional too. A lot of the people still practicing really traditional practices that go back thousands of years.
If I'm there during a ceremony, and the men are walking down the street, I have to shield my eyes. And
oh, is that right?
Yeah, I'm not allowed to look at them, and it's pretty remote.
So what are conditions like, by the way, for the Aboriginal
population
at this point?
Well, can I just say about the schools in Australia?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
The more remote the school, the more funding they get. They have computers and technologies and the latest telescopes, which is wonderful. So even though it's remote, we get a lot of funding for these children here, so they're not lacking. We get permissions to go there because they are bringing us in, but we do have to get the permissions. But they're bringing us in to do literacy projects, and they get that special needs that they get, the extra teachers.
It was interesting. Yesterday, we were at a school yesterday, and I was showing some of the children there the process of creating this book, Jundamara. And part of it was that we were probably about 1,000 kilometres from a shop, so there was no food, there was nothing to buy. So I ate what they ate, which was lizard, and drank water, which was to dig a hole in the ground until the water came up. And we were showing the children yesterday, and they just loved it. They were just, you know,
crocodiles,
and you know, all the process of actually creating the book. There was what I was talking about originally. The adventure of creating this book was as great as the book itself, you know, because wading through crocodile-infested waters and eating a little bit of lizard and bush turkey and drinking muddy water is just...
Eating
honey ants is all just part of the process of creating these books. So
I'm sure Collier does not have to go through this.
But what better way to live your life than to be able to do what we all do, and to find these incredible stories and to be so totally absorbed by them that we just... Because creating a book just doesn't happen, you know, in a blink of the eye. It's a process that takes sometimes years for the writer, and then the artist, or even putting the artist and the writer together and finding that right connection first, and then the process of putting it together takes a long, long time. So generally, you have to find stories that resonate with you as a writer or an illustrator that will resonate with you for a long time. And I don't know. I find that all the books that I've created, they're like children. I watch them grow up, and then when they're made, it's not the finish of it. It's almost the beginning, and because then you share it, but it becomes part of your life. And the books, the stories, perhaps, I don't know, maybe they choose us somehow.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you, by the way, so you're husband and wife, and you've collaborated, I think, seven books, is that over seven?
About 12
or
together,
12 now?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
I was gonna, so what is that? So what is that like? I guess that's right, because people are going to say, well, okay. I mean, because most of us, we live, you know, husband and wife,
we never argue.
Okay, I think you got to ask the neighbors about that. Because we both work from home, it's very funny. We email each other, which is easier. But, what's wonderful working with Mark is because he has this passion, which is contagious, and he's gathered so much of the material for the writing of the book. When it comes to my illustrating, he just takes those boxes and moves them into my studio, and I can very lazily ask him, by the way, in that, what sort of uniform do they wear at this point? He says, well, yeah, this book here. But he also is very generous that when I paint the pictures to go with his words, he sees that he'll take a loss in the writing, like, oh, I can lose those words because she's going to show it in the painting. So he keeps me in mind. But as far as criticism, he's very good, and he knows exactly
how to put it.
He's not going to bite the hand that feeds him. So,
I work with different illustrators, and Frane's worked with many different authors as well. So we've all had a different relationships with different people. One of the things that's really terrific about working with my wife is that if I know that I'm going to be creating a book with her, I almost can visualize the way that she will interpret it to a certain extent. And that really helps with the writing process, because I know that with these books, there's, like Frane was saying, there's got to be part that's left for the illustrator to tell the story as well, because it's like that song that we were talking about right at the very beginning. It's a collaboration, and the two come together, and without both of them telling the same story but in a different way, it's not a successful book. So we've just got to find ways of letting an artist tell pieces of the story as well. That's a really key point.
Carly, now, you do this, you're sort of a solo act, I take it.
Do you collaborate with authors as well, and it is a definite partnership that has to take place. And what I do is I get out of the way of the author when they're writing, and normally my experience is I didn't even meet the author until the whole thing is done. I have no communication with them. Because what my mandate is to interpret the words that are written. So after the author is finished putting the bells and whistles on the text, then I come in and sort of find a way to expand that text and create the characters based on what's there and do my own research. I do a research after all the research is already done, because it's something I need to see that I don't see necessarily in the words. So I break it down and I go in and start building it back up again. I strip it and build it back up again.
So what was, like, for instance, Dave the Potter? Mm-hmm. So the what they've extracted from it, particularly the poems and so on, and the way they've arranged it, that's all done by an author and then...
Okay. And an editor.
And an editor,
and
right.
An editor puts it all together. And then I come in and... And what I'll do is a thumbnail sketch or a storyboard.
Right.
And turn that in to let the editor know how I'm pacing the story and how I'm trying to tell the story. And from there, once we touch and agree on all of that, then I start executing the original artwork, the actual pieces that'll go in the book. And then I start painting. And I'm always open for changes if they can come in the room and bring something that can add to the story. So I'm never comfortable until the book is completely done and everybody's good with it. Because in the 11th hour, if 29 agree and there's 30 in the room, we got a problem. We got to figure this out. Everybody has to agree. And so that's my sort of criteria when I'm turning in artwork and making a book.
So what is this? What is this? I mean, did you envision yourself ever making a living at this? I mean, when you were younger, or was it just something that, or is this a dream come true?
Well, you know, in high school when I was here, I only had one plan. I had a plan A. I said, I'm going to New York and I'm going to be an artist. But at that point, I had a romantic idea about what it was to be an artist, you know. I didn't take into consideration, well, you got to pay rent and pay light bill. And you're in a city where there's a million artists doing the same thing that are way better than you, you know. So I had a wild dream about it. But it's become bigger than even what I've dreamt about. I didn't know. It was harder than I thought it would be, and it's better than I thought it would be. It's all those extremes, you know, being a working artist full time, and living off the artwork that you make, you know, and it's challenging. Even it doesn't matter. There's no landing place here. There's no retirement either. In case you know, so there's challenges on every level. No matter how many awards we all get and how well the book does. There's challenges in the best of circumstances, you know. But as artists, we got to figure those out.
Let me ask you this, just sort of briefly. What advice would you give to somebody who's starting out, who maybe might be thinking about doing something like this? Let me start with you, Collier. What advice would you give?
My advice is to trust your inner voice. Everything in the world will tell you not to do this. Even the people that love you. They'll tell you, go get a job. And this is the most incredible job that you could ever really have. That is not even work. It's a labor of love and passion. Listen to your inner voice and really chase your dream and passion, because that's what's going to sustain you through rough times. Because there will be rough patches where it's just not happening. You don't think you're going to make it to the other side on this thing. So you have to love it. You better be in love with what you do if you want to be an artist or a writer, because that's what you'll need to feed your art, your artistry, is really those rough times, you know. So just be in love. Be in love.
What about you, Mark? What do you think? I mean,
well, I think there's a lot of people you hear say that they've got a book inside them. Everybody probably has a book inside them about stories from family or things that they want to record, but writing's not easy. Writing is something that I think you have to have a pretty thick skin. Along the way, you have to be able to work with people, editors. You have to be able to take advice. You have to be able to consider the advice and make decisions. But most important, you have to have that passion. You have to have a drive too. I don't know if you can give the advice to someone about being a writer. It's just you either will be or you won't be, and it will happen, and people will want to write and drop off from the process because they'll figure out that, you know, it was too difficult, or they went to 30 publishers like Frano and Brian were talking about, and, you know, both of them were very driven to get their first books published, so you have to be very driven. And I just think eventually the process of what we do weeds out the people who fall away, and eventually what you're left with are people who are driven and have that passion. And if you want to be a writer, you perhaps begin the process and see how you go, and see if after 2-3 years or after getting criticism and taking the criticism, whether you can handle it or not. And don't do it because you want to be rich. No, because you want to have a retirement. If those things come along, to some of us, perhaps they may do, but it's not why everybody writes. It's not why everyone's a creative person. People create because it's something deep inside them that they can't stop themselves from doing. And if eventually that happens to be you out there, the listeners who are listening now, you will very quickly find out. It'll be a process, but you will know it. So it's not something that you can really advise someone, but if you want to write, my suggestion is begin.
And then you'll find out. Yeah, Frene, what about you? Any advice? Because you started, I said, well, gee, I'm not very good at this. And then suddenly, whatever you didn't lack or whatever became actually an advantage.
Well, I love talking to children about this, saying that I never thought I was very good at this, because I could all see these little light bulbs coming off of children in the audience who think, I can't paint or I can't draw. But also about writing as well. I said, look, I was never the best writer. I said, I didn't know where to put a period. I didn't know, my sentences went on and end and end and end. And but I always loved reading. I always loved going to the library. And I say to them, write a book or paint a story about something you love, something you want to know more about, something you want to share, because it's that passion again. It's, if you have it, it'll keep you going on it. You won't get, you know, you'll keep your drive going, and then it'll share. It will be contagious, but start with that, something you know, something you want to know more about, something you're interested in, because it is a long process from the original idea to you do have a book in your hand, and you do have to be thick-skinned, and you do have to be to have that inside you, so you really want to make a book. And I believe there's a publisher for every book out there that you have an idea, but it's just getting it to the right person, the right time, and just to keep going with it.
But just before we leave, is there any market for this in terms of the internet and that sort of thing? I mean, tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I think e-books now, self-publishing.
Yeah, self-publishing.
It's no longer a dirty word. It's a selfie revolution, we could call it. But the most important thing about self-publishing, anybody who's considering doing that, you really got to get editorial advice. Just don't go and do it. Because that's disastrous. Especially if you're going to print the hard copy books, your garage is going to be full of books. You really have to have a distributor set up.
Yeah.
You have to know your market. And without taking that advice, it's not going to work. But yeah.
Okay, we've been speaking with what we start out with, Dr. Ernie Bond. He is an associate professor of education at Salisbury University and hosts every year for Salisbury University's 2014 Children's and Young Adult Literature Festival. Also, our guests have been Brian Collier, a native of Pocomoke City, as well as a nationally celebrated artist and illustrator, as well as Renee Lessig and Mark Greenwood, husband and wife who have published several books together, Renee being the artist of the family and Mark being the writer of the family. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.